Hello and welcome to the Crate and Crowbar. This is our 150th episode and we're recording on the 19th of July 2016. My name is Chris Thurston and today I'm joined by Philippa Waugh.
Hello.
And Tom Senior.
Hello.
On this, a day that is truly hot as fucking balls.
Jesus Christ, it's hot. It's so wrong.
If the sound sounds slightly worse or slightly flatter or something this episode, forgive us because we've got a window open and the door open.
I'm in a cardigan eating a Calippo.
Indeed. We've traded spirits for beers and ice lollies.
Yeah.
In an attempt not to die while talking about computer games for the next ever so long. Pip.
Hello.
You've had a warm outdoorsy adventure lately.
Oh.
In several contexts.
Which
some of
one?
Them real, but also in a video game.
Oh, thank God.
Yeah. That was a segue.
Yeah, okay, yeah, no, I thought you were setting me up for some awful anecdote or something.
No.
Oh, good. Anyway.
Lost an umbrella up a tree, though.
Shut up. It wasn't a tree, it was a bramble bush, and it was really tall. And anyway, I got lots of, not brambles, blackberries. Mm.
Excellent.
So, anyway.
Firewatch.
The game I've been playing, do you want to do this?
No.
I've been playing Firewatch.
Excellent.
I played it twice over the weekend.
Oh, wow.
That good?
It kind of, but the second playthrough was because I was far keener to see more of the environments and things. Like, I'll be honest, I haven't really engaged with the plot the second time around, and I'm barely talking to the supervisor that talks to you on the radio and things like that. So I guess this is kind of my curt playthrough in terms of my terse playthrough. But I'm doing a lot more exploring and chasing little animated butterflies around fields. Well, not fields, but I guess clearings and like little creeks and things. So, but yeah, like the reason that I went back a second time so quickly was because it's so beautiful just to sort of be in those environments, and they do a really good job of sort of expressing time of day and temperature through colour and sort of environment and things like that. Like, there's a section that takes place sort of early in the morning, and there's some sort of, you know, low-lying misty patches on the ground, which is clearly going to sort of burn off when the sun gets going and stuff. And it sort of, you do have those real moments of sort of remembering those slightly chilly mornings, but where you don't bother with a jumper or anything because you know that you'll just end up sweating into it later and things. So things like that are really nice. And then it changes the basic palette according to sort of different, I guess, plot events and different sort of times and things, which is interesting. So, shall I explain what it is, or does everyone know?
It's pretty well known now. This is the Campo Santo's walk and talk 'em up.
Forest 'em up, also.
Forest 'em up.
So you're sort of, you are a fire watcher in the Wyoming National Park, or one of them. I'm not sure how Wyoming is off for these things.
Pretty well.
Really?
Mm.
How many?
Several.
100.
Maybe.
Right. Well, you're in one of them. And the game, the story is about sort of what you're doing there and why, and sort of what has gone before you as well, because obviously you are in the tower sort of replacing other people. So there's sort of gentle stories, or, you know, sort of, they're not high octane, basically, but they are interesting stories that play out. And yeah, I think it's just really beautiful, and I wanted to be in that environment more. The thing that the game does that annoys me a bit is that sort of after you've finished key plot points, it just chucks you through to the next sort of set of days. Like, after I'd finished a particular section at night, you know, after I'd sort of achieved whatever the game had wanted me to, it just sort of catapulted me forward to maybe the next day, maybe a couple of days later, I can't remember. And I, because I'd really wanted to explore at night, just because I, you know, as somebody who theoretically hadn't really been out there, I would have wanted to have a look around my environment and stuff. But I think the game kind of, like, you can go off the beaten track and stuff, or, you know, explore, meander your way to the different sort of plot beats and things. But once you've hit them, there's sort of no, I guess the game sort of takes it as read that you are doing some of that exploring or some of that sort of rote stuff in the intervening days. So you know, spend your actual time engaging with the game with the sort of the more, not interesting, but eventful parts. But I would have quite liked the real quiet bits to be heroed in some way as well, rather than sort of be a thing that you have to consciously build in, because I think that took me by surprise a fair few times, and it was only in the second playthrough that I was, you know, deliberately taking my time.
Mm. It's a testament to the environment design that it's nice enough that you're annoyed when it skips you to the exciting things.
I think it's also because I'm in that very particular mindset at the moment. I do a lot of walking in my actual life and spending time outdoors, and I think I was hoping to not exactly replicate that in the game, but it's something that I do a lot of, and I noticed its absence when the game sort of scooted me forwards.
I still need to play it. It's sort of, you know, passed me by quite quickly, but I haven't got around to inside yet either, so that backlog is building and building. What brought you back to it now, out of interest, like having missed it when it first came around?
Well, I didn't miss it when it first came around. I started playing it, but because I wasn't doing a review, and I think I ended up doing a review of something else at the time, it sort of, I got through the first day, and then I just, you know, got sidetracked and then was busy and work trips and things like that. And so this was kind of a weekend where I actually felt like I had the brain space to do a game that sort of might demand something back of me, if that makes sense. And sort of that I wanted to be quiet and contemplative for. But it meant sort of going back in and then trying to remember how the game had started, and then going, oh yeah, okay, fine, I'm in a tower, good, right, fine.
Watching fire.
And so, but yeah, that was cool. I'm also waiting on a series of photos, because in the game you get a little disposable camera, which is an interesting thing that they use to interesting effect. But so you can take sort of the equivalent of screenshots, but you've only got, you know, 18 spaces left on this camera. And so, and at the end, you can order them as real physical, you know, sort of 4x6 prints, which is really nice.
That's clever.
Yeah, so I'm kind of waiting until they arrive to reach an exact verdict on that kind of thing, but I very much feel like I prefer the screenshots that I took while just wandering to the ones that I took deliberately with this sort of disposable camera. And I'm not quite sure, like, I'd like to maybe write about that once I've had a chance to think a bit more about it and once I've got the photos and stuff in front of me, but I'd quite like to dig into why that might be, like whether it's because with screenshots you can just hammer the button and then go through them afterwards and actually see what has worked properly when you're not. Essentially, they let you go back to a whole set of slight variations on a theme when you aren't close enough to it that you're seeing what you think is there. Does that make sense? And so with the disposable cameras, you kind of get one shot, really. You can't just, well, you can go over and over and over, but it's such an expense, really. And because I used to do a lot of film camera stuff, and the cost of developing it just racks up something chronic. And so, you know, you do end up far more sparing. But to the point where I've just spent $15 on, I think it's like 8 prints instead of 18, because I didn't even use the full roll of film. But yeah, so I don't know if that's something that you guys have ever...
I didn't know that was in Firewatch.
Yeah.
Overwatch, like, something else.
Well, it's kind of one of those things where I don't know who reviewed it for PCG or anything, or whether they then got the stuff developed off the back of it, because, yeah.
I'm not sure. Addy Kelly has done something similar, but I'm not sure whether it was in Firewatch or something else. I think what would happen with me in this instance is perhaps similar to what happened to you, Pip, where I have a terrible thing with hoarding ammo in games. So I never use the rocket launcher in Mass Effect because I need to save the giant ammo.
Yeah.
And that would be my rocket launcher, that instant camera. Like, I would just hoard it until the most beautiful moment in the game, and it would never come. I'd probably only get a couple of shots out of it, and that pressure would probably ruin the mechanic for me. But that's just about me more than anything else, like who the person you are and how kind of willing you are to take that chance on a Vista.
Yeah, I'll be honest with you. I'm considering a third playthrough, but wherein I use the camera and take the sorts of photos that I think this guy would take, if you see what I mean.
Role-playing it.
Yeah, like sort of weirdly mediocre, but that being really satisfying. Like, I don't know, I feel like he's the sort of guy that would try and take a picture of, I don't know, a lake, but have that, you know, like how Boots used to do the stickers, like the advice stickers. And so you'd get one on your photo sometimes that was like, we think that your thumb was obscuring the camera. Basically, they, I think, were trying to mitigate blame and stuff. So you'd get like stickers that explained overexposure was a thing, or that, you know, you
really
hadn't taken
you've done a bad job of this. It's not our fault. You fucked it up.
Real printer.
Yeah, seriously.
That's amazing.
So that was kind of interesting. But yeah, I kind of figured he would take, or he'd do that thing where you are winding the camera on and you're not sure if it's quite got to zero yet. And so you take a photo of your own foot a few times just to move it along. But then you realise that, oh no, it was taking photos and now I've lost two and they're just feet. And I'll get another telling off from Boots.
If a 15-year-old played that game now, they would not understand what the hell that thing was and why any of that was happening.
Yeah, they live in a digital rocket launcher age. Yeah,
absolutely.
I don't know, though, because they might be like one of the hipster teenagers that's super into like lomography or something, and they'd just be like, why doesn't this have a fisheye attachment or a colour flash? I say this as somebody who has got both of those in a drawer in the other room. But yeah,
I actually had no idea that was in the game at all.
Did you not?
Photo ordering part of it.
Well,
it's an interesting idea for DLC. You know, post-launch, you know.
Yeah, that's quite cool.
Like getting a physical thing back after you finish the game.
I might do that for The Witcher. Cool. Like, if they said, oh, we'll give you 10 shots and you can print them out and they'll be big, beautiful prints. I might actually go to my favourite parts of The Witcher world and...
Yeah, like, because it's an extra cost, but I would happily do that kind of thing. Because I was also thinking of... Because I do, like, things with manipulating screenshots and editing them and stuff, and I've ordered some of those to get printed on photo paper, you know, just, like, because Bonus Print and people just let you upload your own work to be printed, and usually I sort of, well, I've been doing sort of my insect pictures and stuff recently, but I was thinking, and I've got an order in a basket, and I'm just trying to work out whether there's anything to add, but... Like, I did a series of, like, mashup kind of things. Like, I'd get, like, manipulate images from Dota's, like, cinema camera that I'd go in, and, like, of overhead views of spell effects and stuff, and, like, abstract them out and sort of do weird pixelated effects and stuff like that. So I was thinking I might print some of those out and just sort of see... Like, essentially just sort of see what it all looks like, like, as an actual physical artifact, because that's so alien to my job now, I guess.
Yeah, I'm interested to see how the Firewatch pictures turn out, whether it feels like snaps from a holiday you didn't really go on, or like, you know, pictures of a game, what you might get in a magazine. Because, I mean, you know, I do have looked at a lot of printed pictures from video games in my life, but in a very different context.
I think there is something about the act of transferring it onto photographic paper that is very, very different from
it's probably true.
Anything else, which I found when I printed out a bunch of stuff that was from my Instagram account. And it was just like, oh, these look so different now. Yeah. And not just because of the RGB to... like, you know, print color palette. CMYK.
Very interesting.
But yeah, so that's been me. What about you two? Which one?
I guess I'll go first. I've been playing lots of GTA Online recently.
Did you guys do a heist?
We're working our way through the heists, the Peace Gamer team. Samuel Roberts, Phil Savage, me, and Tom Hatfield are going through them one by one. And I think we're on the last one now. We're just kind of knocking down the little mini missions and going through it. And it's an amazing experience if you do it with the same group of people, but it's definitely exposed a lot of shitty Rockstar mission design that just keeps on happening in those games. And there kind of needs to come a point, I think, when critics stand up and say, this is just bad. And, you know, their world building is incredible. A lot of, you know, their atmospheric stuff is fucking sensational, but man, some of their mission, just putting missions together, just doesn't work and is annoying and boring. And they make basic mistakes like checkpointing before a long drive, before a cutscene. All this stuff that just every other developer in the world just doesn't do now, because it's just obvious. There's still that, they just still do that to you.
I wonder why.
Don't know. Couldn't say. but it's endemic throughout the online heists, and a lot of them are actually really well put together. And when it works, it's fucking amazing. Because you all have different roles. You're all kind of in different parts of the map, and you're assaulting a base, and some people will be in a helicopter in the air doing something, and I might be underground in an underwater kind of tunnel with my night vision on, shooting guys. And you could both be having the same experiences at the same time, but still in communication, hearing each other over chat, and trying to sync up those different experiences in your head into one overall heist as it's happening. And that's it's really exciting, and it's, you know, actually cinematic in the sense that they just nick a lot of this stuff from cinematic heist scenes and make you do things that you've seen other people do in films. All that stuff's really exciting, but it's also kind of frustrating in equal measure. And add on to that kind of a layer of shonkiness in terms of it just takes ages to get into games. Loading times are really long. So you can still just get dropped out and get disconnected. And it feels like GTA Online is this incredibly ambitious thing, and it's incredibly successful from what I've heard. Like, apparently one of the reasons why they're not really churning out the single-player DLC is because they just make loads and loads of money from people buying cars and stuff in online. That's just a way for people to hang out now. They just get in with some friends and go online, and there's loads of new missions and stuff to do, lots of cars to steal. You set up your own business. So Hatfield set one up called Triple Triad, named after the Final Fantasy VIII card game. And
that's quite good, actually.
Yeah, it's nice. And he got he got an office building, and once he had kind of employed us all, we were allowed to go up into the boardroom. And you can all sit down around the boardroom table, and it's like a little map of Los Santos carved into it. And you can press left, and your guy will kind of swing left in a kind of corporate manner and like stroke his chin. and you can, if you press right, he'll do that, the same thing in the other direction. And you can kind of role play a business meeting. But only the owner of the company is allowed to sit at the head of the table. And when they press the command to sit at the head of the table, no matter what they're armed with or what is on their person, they pull out a huge revolver and put it down on the table before they sit down, which is just hilarious. And then it's really, really, really good. That stuff's great. It's just I wish that they'd kind of do better with their missions and with like their incidental characters. Like the number of times I've run into the template gibbering, screaming, office tits gut bloke with long hair and a sweat-stained shirt in GTA 5 is just, you know...
That's pretty much me right now, though, in real life.
That is us right now, but, you know, just over and over again, the same character.
We would wilt in Los Santos.
Oh, God, yeah.
It's, yeah, I haven't actually gone back because I was playing through them all with the same group of friends, which was really good, and this was ages ago before the updates. And we did a fun thing, which was get a themed tattoo after every successful heist. But I think the thing that struck out to me about it is it was almost a case for not having a fail state. Like, the magic dies the moment you fail. Especially if, like, one half of the team is having trouble with their half and the other team is fine, but you're all kind of repeating all of it You know what I mean? Yeah. The repetition sort of kills the magic a little bit. Like, it'd almost be better if you couldn't fail.
I think repetition exposes how kind of straightforward the mission design is as well. It's very much go to point from point A to point B and kill X number of people, then get into X vehicle. So there's once where, like, we had a really, really, really long jet ski ride to an island. And the objective was to go on board the island, kill everyone on the island, and then escape via the escape boat. So I rocket launched the escape boat, thinking it was an enemy, perhaps. and it instantly failed us, and we had to do the whole thing again.
Oh, shit.
And obviously, like, my team was annoyed at me, which is fair enough. But this is a game where you should just be able to rocket launch stuff, because it massively encourages that attitude, and it's that kind of freestyling, blow things up and just watch the spectacle happen. And then you do it in the wrong way, and it'll just go, no, now you must replay a really boring section for ages. That is your punishment. You're not allowed to have any fun for the next 5 minutes.
There's a really pointedly punishingly designed bit, I think, maybe in the second heist, where one player has to go pick up a passenger plane from the airport and just get ready to pick the rest of the players up. And that was me for the time when we were playing it. And it meant... And the other players are doing hard things involving, like, breaking into a prison with a bus and trying to steal an attack helicopter to blow up fighter planes and all this stuff. And all that stuff can be failed. And so it must have taken us a whole evening. But all I did all evening was spawn, get in a car, drive to the airport, get in the plane, take off, fly around, try not to die.
Yeah, you were just circling and stuff, weren't you?
Yeah, really? And every time someone failed, I was still trying to keep a good attitude about it. It's like, oh, no, it's gone wrong again. I'll do
was
this
Was that
again.
With me as well? Because I think
we have done that one together. The time it was really punishing was when I was playing with other people, I think.
Aw. that's nice. Are you, is that the one where you, towards the end, sort of end up in the sea and have to swim to a helicopter on the beach and then leave? Because I remember,
yes, I think so.
I was playing that with people and we got to that point, I think first time, and it was awesome, but I was coming at the helicopter from the back of it.
Oh no.
And walked into the propeller bit. And it,
oh, sweetie.
Yeah, then we had to restart because I was shredded on the beach and people were a bit like, that didn't get dropped for quite some time.
Best thing
that time that Pip walked into the helicopter. Yeah, shut up.
I'll tell you, the best thing you can possibly ever do in GTA is find the helicopter that has the big magnet dangling underneath it. And fly around the map just trying to kidnap Pip in whatever car she's in at the time.
Oh,
she hates that.
I'd forgotten how much bullying happened to me in GTA. Because in multiplayer online, it was... I think you and Dan also... Because I couldn't work out how to use the parachute for the longest time. And I was asking you guys for help and you'd tell me the wrong button every time. And you'd be like, oh, no, now I'll help you. And then it would still be the wrong button and I'd die. And then I'd have to run up and get another parachute. And then the other one of you would just be like, oh, for God's sake, don't listen to him, it's this.
Yeah,
and
it
say it really
be.
Seriously and then I'd die again. I hate was, you all.
I think one of my favourite things about that, because it was sort of nice studying the heists between just sort of living in that world. And I think, because I do think the game design is shonky and there's lots of problems with it. And my favourite memories of it always come from just sort of weird little kind of ad hoc interactions with the systems, like the tattoo thing. But also, like, after one heist, we decided we were all going to the beach. So everyone had to go to the clothes shop and buy a new set of, like, garish beach clothes, like Hawaiian shirts and flip-flops and stuff. And then we all got in a little seaplane and went down to the beach and had a grand old time. It was nice and you know, sort of sweet. And then we got back into the car and drove off on the rest of the holiday to go kill people and rob things and stuff.
I liked it when it was just playing with friends and things, but then sometimes some rando would show up and shoot me in the head.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes some dickhead would blow up your car that you didn't have insured and you really liked. Yeah, and then feel so guilty about it that he spent the next 3 hours roping people into trying to find another car that was exactly the same so he wouldn't notice.
Yeah.
And that's why we don't play GTA anymore.
No.
But yeah, have they added any heists? Have they changed?
They've not added any heists. They've definitely added some... quite a lot of mission content, especially around the new businesses. So you do kind of cargo stealing missions and kind of transportation missions for your business.
They've also added just quite a lot of cars and things, haven't they? And just
loads
other,
of kind of bling, I suppose, stuff to own. It's just kind of stuff to really sink your money into. I think one of the reasons why the heists are challenging and they can't just be breezed through is because you get loads and loads of money for doing it.
Mm.
That's actually money you can buy with real money if you choose to. So if they don't want people farming, well, people I think do farm the last heist, like the first half of the last heist, because you just get it's really easy money. So it's slightly a shame. However, I have enjoyed buying a really awesome car and just kind of putting stupid lights on it and spending like 300,000 fun bucks on a big silly muscle car. I don't even care about cars, but I still like that thing.
Yeah,
it's really good at drawing you into its world and making you kind of care about that stuff.
Mm. This does make me want to reinstall it. Actually, I haven't run it on my shiny PC.
Oh, yeah.
I imagine it would look
lovely. It looks beautiful. Lovely. I mean, online looks amazing, even though they've cut out a load of graphical effects from the single player. Like, I think there's a certain integrity to the single player that they've cut down for the multiplayer stuff.
I just hated all the load times. Like, when you're trying to get into the game in the first place, it's just minutes and minutes, and you're just like, for God's sake.
Yeah.
Like, you know, by the time you've had your cup of tea and, you know, done your tax return, and the game still hasn't booted in, and you're just like, well.
And you're booting to different worlds, and then you have to do the rigmarole of kind of joining other people's games, and then you've got the same, like, long loading time again, and it's
but
not
then
a
sometimes it's like the server's full.
Yeah,
you're just like, oh, God,
yeah.
Has it become much more stable from launch? Because that, I guess, be the thing that would get me back into it.
It's a lot more stable than it was. We've only had people drop out twice, probably in the heist we've done the last 2 weeks, and that's over probably about 10 to 15 hours of play.
That's good,
which is good. But like, for example, Samuel dropped out at the very end of a mission we were doing, and it just ends the mission right there. And you lose your checkpoint, so you have to start from the very beginning of that heist mission over again. And it's just, again, it's stuff like that that it just seems like ABC just don't have that happen. Either have a 5 to 10 minute grace period where the person can get back into the game, save checkpoints for everyone. Stuff like Destiny is just solved, straight up solved with its kind of raiding stuff.
Yeah,
that makes for a good comparison, actually.
Mm.
Huh.
It always feels like they didn't kind of intend to make what they ended up making, or that they built the. Well, they built something really, you know, spectacular in some ways on quite infirm foundations when it comes to the sort of basic work of making a multiplayer game.
Yeah, and I mean, it is astonishing the kind of physics, the verisimilitude of it as a kind of physics experience online. It's pretty remarkable. Everyone, the things exploding and flying around and everyone seeing the same thing. I think as a technical feat, in some ways, it's very impressive. The integrity, like you don't see that stuff in the Division, for example, where everything is a very static backdrop.
And a lot of it's client side,
yeah, precisely. And in that way, GTA Online is very impressive, but you have to sacrifice a lot of stuff to get that.
Yeah, and it also just doesn't paper over any sort of bad mission design stuff, because that's
it's just bad.
Well, you could be that person. You are that person for calling them out. You mentioned
indeed,
earlier
on a podcast that they will never listen to.
We could send
take
it
that,
to them,
Rockstar.
we could print it out and send it to them.
Yeah, we could put it on the internet. If only we had a platform of some kind.
Oh well, we have to remain voiceless. It's weird because there's lots of good ideas in those missions. Like, we're going to do a prison break, or we're going to nick things from an aircraft carrier or whatever. But somehow it doesn't quite sort of gel into like really meaningfully fun mechanics for four people.
Finding something for everyone to do is a huge problem in those missions. That must be an incredibly hard challenge. So it's that thing of, I think Sam went mad driving a bus over and over again because that was his role in the mission. And I guess you can kind of swap it out, but if you swap people around, you increase the chances that of the accidental fuck-ups happening that set you back for a huge amount. So everyone sticks to their role. And that's when the kind of grinding boredom comes in, if you have to repeat long time.
It's funny because I actually instinctively like the idea of specialization because, I watched the A-Team literally every day as a teenager when it was on UK TV Gold at 5 o'clock every weekday. So I would come home from school and watch the A-Team. And I think I internalized a lot of like that sort of buddy caper heist adventure stuff because it's so formulaic, but there are things I quite like about it that translate into GTA quite well, like the notion that everyone on the team has the thing they do because people like feeling like they're specialized.
Thunderbirds does it as well.
Yeah, I absolutely adored Thunderbirds as well. Like there's there's a lot of fiction like that that sort of draws from. And so, like, in GTA, just because, like, I'd always sort of taken it upon myself to get good at flying the planes in GTA games. When I got to GTA 5, I could still do the planes. So I was the planes guy. If there was a planes or a helicopters-related thing, that could be me. And I quite liked knowing that, even though it put me in some boring situations. Mm. It's like, well, I'm the pilot, and that's kind of what I do.
I can't fly planes in GTA. It's totally beyond me. I don't understand, like, the physics of it.
But that's cool. Like, I like that people can, like, you know, I was always really crap at the gunplay in GTA. Like, I never really got it, or, you know, died too much, or was knocked down too much, and all the rest of it. And I quite like having, you know, like, I don't mind sitting on a runway. Like, my favourite moment in those heists was getting the plane down on the runway and just needing the team to get in because we need to go, and, like, watching this bus half on fire come hurtling down the road in the opposite direction, chased by a load of cop cars, and me just sort of, like, keeping the engine warm on the runway, like, come on, guys, come on, we're going, we're going, we're going. Like, that's I really like that. I don't mind not being involved in every piece of the action. But I feel like there's a lot of repetition and sort of guff that sort of, you know, scratch away at that.
Yeah. The good moments, like, that is a great moment. Like, when we did that moment, I think it's the second or third heist, it was absolutely incredible. Because we had the same rush to get out and get into the plane. And I think Sam was just shooting down police choppers around us. And I was in the plane in first person looking out of the window as it was taking off, seeing police choppers exploding as Sam just kind of buzzes past in a plane or something. And those moments are absolutely extraordinary. Like, there are brief 5-minute like stretches of GTA Online in the heists that are some of the best online experiences I think you can have with a few mates. It's just that you're right, you have to wade through so much to get to it.
I think, like, there's something I really appreciate about co-op. Because I'm not a massive co-op fan generally. Like, I'm not a fan of co-op when it's like everyone's doing the same thing.
Yeah.
Like, I like co-op when it is slightly asymmetrical, because I think one of the cool things about that is individuals have a chance to show off, but also it encourages you to sort of appreciate your friends. Yeah. Like, part of the fun of it isn't I get to be the coolest. It's look at my friend being cool as well. And we all feel like different superheroes, like, whatever the context is.
Yeah, sure.
Like, you know, I got a bit bored of Left 4 Dead after a while because we felt interchangeable. And ultimately, the vocabulary, it's a great game, but the vocabulary is quite simple. And it tries to create those moments through dependency, like, oh, my friend has been grabbed by a zombie, I've got to go rescue them.
Yeah.
But it doesn't really compare to that thing of, like, yeah, like, being grateful to see, I don't know who's flying the helicopter rescue first, but, like, yeah, to see the helicopter tear past blowing someone up, or your mates rolling in a car and pile out to help you, and that notion that you're all having different experiences, but you could sort of appreciate each other's contribution, I really like.
Yeah. And the chatter you get on comms is amazing as well. Like, when you're actually in the thick of the action, you actually sound like people doing a heist. And, you know, I've got your flank. And this, and all that kind of stuff that is so cliche. You just find yourself saying it in the middle of this. And I do enjoy that.
I think there's a thing where it's really awesome when people click with a role and when they can show off, or when you can sort of revel in someone else doing something really cool. But there's also the converse of that where, you know, if you're the one that's fucking up and resetting the checkpoint and all of that kind of stuff, you can feel like the worst, shittiest, like, member of the team, and you know that everyone's, you know, like, secretly a bit.
I think that's why the scenarios just need to be designed not to bottleneck players on certain things. Like, I think GTA has that when it splits the team and two people go one place, two people split, people go the other.
Yeah.
And one pair's thing is a lot harder than the others. There's a few instances of that.
Yeah.
Where if you're the pair that is just sort of breezing through it and, you know, waiting in the car at the safety house, or safe house.
The safety house.
Yeah.
No scissors there.
Exactly. We can house if you want to leave your friends behind. But, you know, if you're there waiting there and you fail again, you're like, come on, guys, what the fuck is your problem? And then you realize that they're doing some sort of, you know, bollock sniper challenge that, you know, is really difficult. Then, you know, it's not core concept stuff. It's just tuning and delivery and, you know, like, if all of the edges were perfectly smooth in that experience, it would be amazing.
Yeah.
I think GTA isn't really the game for it, simply because tonally I don't think it would work. But it would be really nice if you could maybe fail some bits. Like, there's, you know, like, there's an incentive for doing it amazingly, but someone can fuck up and that doesn't stop the thing. You just have to live with the consequences of that, you know?
Yeah.
Like in Hitman or something, you can still, you know, muddle your way through something. You won't have been stealthy and you know, you might have left an entire disaster zone in your wake, but, you know, you can still get out of the mission with the objectives broadly achieved. And so it would be quite nice if there was some sort of way to try and improvise your way out of a catastrophe rather than just fail.
I think this is the thing, and so I was thinking about this because it is a case for, you know, a more robust soft failure sort of thing where there are, you know, the heist can go badly and you can get less reward, but it's not over.
Or you spend some of the reward getting someone out of prison or something.
Yeah. However, I think one of the issues with GTA's core design is that there are a few basic things that generally work against the AI. And there are a few basic ways to escape every scenario that just kind of work unless you're forced not to use them. Like either shooting everybody or getting in a car and just driving in a straight line to the police across the country so the police struggle to follow you. And if you were, like, so, for example, if you were in that amazing situation where you got to get the bus to the plane, then you got to all get in the plane and get away, if you were allowed to, so for example, lose the bus, get in a car, or even lose the plane and get in a car and drive to the beach rendezvous or whatever, I think it would probably feel more forgiving and it would be less frustrating in the short term. But I imagine most heists would probably end the same way. And this is not a reason for them not to do it, because it just highlights a weakness in the way they designed the game. But because those encounters, if you just sort of muddle through them, basically become very samey, because it's like, oh, a car got destroyed, get in a different car, drive away. It would remove a lot of the kind of the variety of the heist, and actually I think it would reveal how formulaic the underlying game is. They encourage these kind of spectacular moments to happen by forcing you to do it a particular way. So if you lose the bus, that's game over, try it again. And they're taking a really hard line in order to get you to do the interesting ending. Whereas I don't think that's necessarily a good reason for it to be that way. It's just, it feels like a crutch they're leaning on to enable probably what's a better experience. And maybe there's an argument to be made that once you've done it and you've had that spectacular ending, you forget a lot of the times that you felt frustrated or bored, because your most recent memory is
the really heroic
is the success.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know, because I tend to remember the hilarious fuck-ups, if you see what I mean. Like, and it would be quite nice if they had gone somewhere, I guess. I think, I can't 100% say this was a heist, but I think it was. And I was driving a car to get away from something and was trying to rendezvous with someone. I'm not 100% sure, like, of any of the parameters of this, but all I remember is that I took what I thought was going to be a shortcut away from the police and ended up stuck halfway down a zigzag staircase in my car. And it would have been quite nice if that had led to something sort of happening off the back of it. And I appreciate that it's going to be a massively, like, complicated and in-depth thing to do, because the game is so sprawling that, you know, if you start introducing variety, it just adds so much sort of work to the game, and the project just takes 12 more years or something. But I'd quite like it if those moments weren't just sort of dead ends, I guess, in the thing, that they'd actually led to, you know, a different sort of hair-raising end to a mission.
I think maybe one way to fix this is, rather than just say, like, mission over, to sort of escalate the difficulty until you kind of guaranteed to fail, but let you fail on your own terms. So, like, you lose the bus or whatever. Have it so that it maybe pins you into an impossible situation and you have your last stand and you all die, and then you restart it. And it may end up taking longer, but it might feel less arbitrary than just sort of hitting those
But I guess if you fucked up and then you knew you had, because you knew the parameters of a successful mission by that point, you wouldn't want, you know, there would be nothing for you to play to the end of that point. So you'd quit.
It's whether or not the game should lie to you, you know what I mean? Yeah. And just sort of say, you have a chance at this, but it's going to get exponentially more difficult unless you do it the right way. And maybe even allow you to succeed hypothetically, but only against exponentially difficult odds. I don't know if that's a very good solution, but I think they've backed themselves into a corner, basically.
Like, that's a really, like, it would be interesting to experiment with those approaches, but they're kind of very resource heavy approaches. I think that they could solve so many of the problems by just streamlining their checkpointing.
Yeah,
and just a little bit, just kind of softening of the checkpointing and thinking a bit about, what if the player had to do this five times, what would become irritating about this? Fair enough. That annoying cutscene that plays for 45 seconds, they're gonna have to watch that five times. Don't do that to them, you know. Just really ABC stuff like that would automatically make it a better experience, I think, by substantially.
Yeah, especially if it was maybe just like slightly smarter things, like it would, if you were clearly having a session, like if you were at that point and it had been less than a day since you last did it, it didn't play the cutscene. But if it was, you know, maybe the next evening and you might need a refresher, it did it the once or something.
Or just let you skip it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Something like that.
It's kind of cool though. I do like it. We're definitely going to finish it.
There's still nothing like it.
Absolutely, yeah. Chris, what have you been playing?
I've had a series of virtual experiences, one not so long ago before we recorded this podcast. I don't recommend having virtual experiences in sweaty, muggy heat, because you take that £600 HTC Vive headset and turn it into a lovely facey sponge.
We could have jammed some Calippos down the side of it for you.
As you say, £600 headset stuffed with Calippos. But also dreams. So over the weekend, I went to Star Wars Celebration in London, which is sort of, you know, the year's big Star Wars event. I went as a member of the public due to my enduring love for a series that it just keeps hitting you in some ways. But actually, it's gotten really good in the last couple of years, and it's now a very exciting time to be a fan. The event itself, I don't want to say too much about, other than the fact that I thought it was surprisingly crap, and I say that as somebody who loves Star Wars to bits. I saw people, and it's nice, and the fans are great and stuff, but just a really big shop, surprisingly little to do, and huge queues for any of the stuff there was to do. However, Sam from PC Gamer and I managed to get a press appointment to see the HTC Vive demo. Star Wars demo that Lucasfilm have been making under their new sort of venture, which is called ILM X-Lab, which is Industrial Light and Magic's kind of VR division, basically. And this actually then came out on Monday. We thought we were going to get some hot scoops, but actually it's called Trials on Tatooine, and it's now out. And if you have a Vive, you can just play it from
Steam.
They're
also demoing at GDC, I guess.
It's been around for a while, but yeah.
I know this because I was sat across the room watching someone else play it.
Yeah. And so that makes sort of interesting thing one, because it's a short 15-minute sort of VR demo that I don't think would blow your mind if you'd used VR before, but I think probably makes for probably one of the better introductions to VR I can think of. Like, if I had to, like, you know, stick the HTC Vive on my mum and show her anything, that would be an amazing one, I think. I say that having a mum who likes Star Wars. I don't know if you would necessarily go for that otherwise, but because it has a lot of things that VR demos don't, in that it's very high fidelity, it has a bit of interaction, the environment looks great, and it's also set within a sort of recognisable enough fantasy universe that you're aware that what you're seeing is sort of remarkable. Like, you're seeing something familiar, but alien, because it's sci-fi, from a perspective you wouldn't normally see it. And so the idea is, it even has a little backstory. They had Dave Filoni, who's the showrunner of Star Wars Rebels, the cartoon, do the sort of story creative development for it and the voice direction and stuff. And the idea is that it's the years after Return of the Jedi, and you are a young Padawan in the New Jedi Order, doing Jedi training things on Tatooine, waiting for a delivery.
And you know what happens to Padawans?
They're generally fine.
There was one notable exception.
There's some notable exceptions, but we don't talk about that because it takes place during the Forbidden movies. It opens. There's a lot of cute things it does. It gives you the Star Wars crawl, but in VR, and so you're actually sort of floating in space, and the words are kind of rolling under you and ahead of you, and it it feels kind of rad. It's sort of like, you're, I don't know, it's a weird effect. And then after that fades, the Falcon flies directly over your head, which is like, it's the opening of, cool. It's, you know, it's the opening of A New Hope with a different ship, but with the idea that you can just look up and sort of gaze in wonder as it flies over. And then it fades to black. And when it fades back, you're standing on the desert in Tatooine. It's dusk. And it's that kind of like, sort of iconic time of day with the two suns and there's a lot of light peeking out over from a hill and there's moisture evaporators and crates and you're in a kind of dusty scrapyard kind of looking place.
So does this mean that you're well placed to answer the question, what happens if you cry while using VR?
I didn't cry. I did stare on in wonder. And so I've actually done this twice now. So I did it once at the show and I've done it subsequently using R5. I did like experiment a bit more when I played it the second time, but the Vive we have currently is a bit fucked. And so, as I think we've said on the podcast before, so it's not a perfect...
Suddenly you lurch to one side and it can't motion track every bit of the play space, which
it wigs out. So none of this is ideal. But, so you're standing on the desert in Tatooine, and that's a really nice experience just to sort of... And it's silent, well, apart from natural sound of the wind and stuff, and you can sort of just soak in the sort of ambiance. And then these sort of like what look like big Star Wars landing lamps sort of go like dunk, 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 dunk around you. And you hear the sort of distant roar and you can look onto the horizon and just see sort of through the heat shimmer, the Falcon kind of approaching low over the horizon. It kind of circles around above you and the landing gear come down and it lands. And that feels great. That's just a really, and they've got quite a good Han Solo sound. The like he sort of shouts down to you from the cabin. You don't see him because I think human characters are going to be a big problem for VR generally. But the ramp comes down and R2-D2 comes out and there is something really, again, it's that VR thing of having to break through your expectation of what's happening to you. Like, you're not controlling a camera that you can point at things in a sort of 3D diorama. You are actually functionally there to some extent, although you can't interact physically with things. And so when I first played it the ILM thing, the two people from ILM were in the room and I felt a bit self-conscious. So I was like sort of interacting, but stoically in a sort of like, well, I suppose if you would like me to pat R2-D2, then I will. But I'm not going to go out my way. Whereas when I was playing it by myself, I like kneeled. And you can kneel and just have a look at him. Sort of like, not pat him, but you know. It's like
give him a little cuddle, you know.
It's like he's push there.
Him. Give him a push.
Don't be mean.
Stroke his cheek.
Yeah.
So finally we are together.
I don't
have... Little kisses. Oh,
he's so smug. All his bleeping and blooping.
It's the character in Star Wars that you're most like, Pip.
Ugh. Maybe that's why I don't like him.
Yeah, you feel a sort of intense rivalry.
Yeah.
With a bin on wheels. A sassy bin.
Who eats data and hides important maps.
Yeah, indeed. And then, like, something on the Falcon breaks, and it is sort of traditional Star Wars stuff, and you have to, like, pull down this big panel thing so that R2-D2 can get a closer look. And it is sort of teaching you about interacting, and you push some buttons and stuff, and it looks and sounds great. And some TIE fighters attack, and they get fended off by the turret on the Falcon, but that, again, is just like a sort of, you're stood there, and that you get strafed by TIE fighters. And it's pure roller coaster, but there's something about that that's really effective, if that's a fiction you've always wanted to step into. And eventually an Imperial shuttle arrives and drops off a load of stormtroopers that charge you. And and Han says something like, you know, R2's got your delivery for you. And do you remember that bit in Return of the Jedi where R2 like fires Luke's lightsaber into the air and Luke grabs it in midair?
Yeah, the Jabba the Hutt sequence. Yeah.
He doesn't shoot it into the air, but he has like a little hatch opens on top of R2-D2 and like the hilt of a lightsaber comes out. Sweet. And you can kind of reach in and grab it and then press the button on the Vive and it's, you know, it does the proper zoom.
Yeah.
And a lot of, from basically the Wiimote onwards, the purpose of any VR sort of motion captured thing was to do a lightsaber, and they've finally just done it and done it exactly right, really. Like, it feels amazing. And the game is super simple. All you do is deflect blaster bolts back at stormtroopers, ineptly, really. But you can play with it and stuff. And then eventually the demo ends, and you're allowed to keep playing with the lightsabers. You float through the credits, which is the best bit. And it's mega simple, and it's very effective, and it kind of bodes well for... It bodes well that a company with Lucasfilm's resources is investing this heavily in experimenting with this stuff. Not just for VR, but for Star Wars games generally, because... Disney famously axed a lot of projects all at once in order to focus on mobile games and things like Disney Infinity. And
they still have their research labs, though, don't they?
They do, but they...
Like
they,
a whole bunch of stuff.
But recently, they, with Battlefront and the EA stuff they have started to reinvest in traditional games, basically. And this feels like the, you know, the first part of something, or it could grow into something. But you're not necessarily sure what it's going to go into. Mm. And it also, in addition, it looks great and sounds great, but the moment it becomes... Like, whenever you're asked to interact with something is the moment that VR is not as convincing as it could be.
Mm.
Because, you know, the moment when I was stood there in the desert, it felt like watching the falcon land. There was nothing about that to take me out of the experience, really.
Yeah.
Maybe, you know, I couldn't smell it. I couldn't feel the wind, you know, buffeting me as the ship came down. But, like, but beyond that, I felt very there. Whereas as soon as, to be honest, even as soon as I'm waving the lightsaber around, it doesn't feel quite right. There's something about it that's gamey, or, you know, it doesn't 100% correspond with what I can feel, and so on. And that's an inevitable problem of VR. But it sort of makes me wonder where the line is going to be, particularly for these licensed experiences, because I'd have the VR experience that was just watching things happen around me. Like, you know, like I'm watching a movie, but I'm in the scenes watching them play out around me, but I'm not myself asked to take a part in it.
Yeah.
It's unrealistic. Or I'm just stood in a place from Star Wars. And I know I've made arguments in the context that I think Star Wars is very much defined by places and vistas and, you know, often events in places. But, you know, I want the thing where I can stand in the corridor of the Death Star and just watch people walk past.
So maybe something more like theatre experiences.
Yeah, like in-situ stuff.
And yeah, I was going to say.
Installations. So like
a drowned man.
Or secret cinema when they did their Star Wars thing, you know, not miles off just with...
Or even just, you know, stuff like the globe.
Yeah.
You know, just being able exactly to actually sort of walk around and...
There's definitely room for that, because I'm not sure how they're going to do the Jedi game. And the reason for that is there's another game I've been playing, which came out in Early Access today, called... Shit,
Raw Data.
It's got a terrible name. I keep thinking...
Well, it's number 10 on the Steam charts, I think.
Which bodes well for the sales of the Vive, because it's VR only. But so Raw Data... I always forget the name because it's a terrible name for a game.
I thought it was a spreadsheet app or something. Yeah.
Raw Data actually has quite a lot of similarities with the Trials and Tatooine thing, just in terms of... Well, it has basically lightsabers in it and combat and, you know... almost like wave survival kind of thing. It's a VR combat game set in a sort of cyberpunk universe that feels, and I've probably played about half an hour of it, and I haven't tried multiplayer yet, but it feels like it's probably about the most advanced actual game someone's made with VR so far. Because, like, a lot of them are experiments or proof of concepts built around a single thing. So this is going to be proof of concept built around guns. This is going to be proof of concept built around bows. This is going to be based on... you know, something, and there's like one experience that you play that game for. Like, I want to play the game that's about bouncing things back with a shield. Or...
I think there are very few things I've encountered in VR that have actually been anything other than experiences.
Or single shot game mechanics where it's like just one thing. Whereas this is the first thing that feels quite substantial, and it's got missions, it's got a lobby, it's got, you know, multiplayer where obviously your friends need to be connected online and also have their own Vives and stuff. So a limited audience to that at the moment. But I do want to play more of it. Shitty Vive notwithstanding. But, you know, it actually feels like a game. Not to say the others aren't games, and I'm going to get into that tiresome discussion. But, you know, it feels like a product with, like, so you load in into, like, the game, and you've like broken into some sort of cyberpunk penthouse office, which is where the tutorial takes place, but also where your mission hub is, and you sort of pick things from screens, and it's all in VR. And while you're standing normally, your hands are modeled somewhat crudely, but you can see your hands, and then if you squeeze the triggers on the sides of the Vive and so on, the hands move sort of realistically, so you can grab and make a fist and stuff like that. And all of the stuff that you do with your hands and your weapons as you get them is based on realistic movements, and this is a little bit chunky at first for me because of the problems we have with that our Vive has with tracking. But as soon as you start to chain stuff together, it's really well considered. So you have, if you have a pistol, it'll be on your hip, and you specify what your dominant hand is. So for me, it's on my left hip, and then to draw your pistol The long button on the side of the Vive controller is used for the grab, basically. You put your hand to your hip in real life and grab, and that'll draw the gun. And on your other hip, you have your ammunition reserve. So if you're shooting with one hand, you can grab a clip with your other hand without even thinking about it, and then slam it into the bottom of the gun. And at first, that feels weird and a bit fiddly, but as soon as you get used to it, it's second nature. But you're actually reloading a gun in what is obviously a first-person shooter in a way that feels... It's not like as involved as something like Receiver, but there's something about scrambling for a clip that suddenly the game is simulating, yeah. Which feels really good.
That's cool.
But you can also pass the gun from one hand to the other, because the grab action is like a consistently realized mechanic. So yeah. it highlights things so that you know what you'll grab. But if you bring your hands together and then grab with the hand that doesn't have the gun, it'll transition it from one to the other. And it's not one-to-one with what your hands are actually doing. You're not actually passing an object. But once you kind of abstract it that little bit, it feels so cool to, like, be behind a pillar taking cover, and you're actually taking cover in real life, not up against something, but pretending like you are. And then you've realized it'd be easier if you could shoot with your right hand rather than your left. So you pass your gun to your right hand and then just blind fire around the corner while reaching down to your hip with your left hand to grab the clip from your hip and then slam it up into the gun and step back. And then on one of the pads, you have a button you can hold to like send out a teleport beam. It's the now traditional how you move with a Vive thing where you kind of pick a point on the floor and you teleport there. And that becomes an essential part of combat as well, that you have to kind of get used to, that you can do a limited amount of running around within the area that you're in, but then you sort of throw yourself across the room like Night Stalker from the X-Men before like drawing a pistol or two pistols and so like go to town on people. You also have, there's a character that has like a sword that you pick off your back and then ignite, but you can also bring your hands together and grab to go into a two-handed grip where you sort of hold the two Vive controllers together, but in the game you're seeing your character with like a proper two-handed grip, and then your arms move realistically.
Oh, cool.
You're not just floating hands or floating paddles.
Right.
You see your own arms in front of you holding it, and because it can extrapolate where your real arms kind of have to be, that you tell it how tall you are, and I think it uses that to kind of figure out roughly where your body will be. It feels really good, and I think it'll feel better with finesse. Like I had problems with like I would want to teleport strike somebody, like by, you know, essentially blinking on top of them with the teleport and then like running them through with the sword. But sometimes I'd blink really, really close to them, and then the game would struggle to reconcile how hard I was hitting them.
Right.
Because it does have there's no like sword attack button. You just hit them with the thing.
Yeah.
And the, you know, if you were right in front of them, I think it sometimes struggles to register like how much damage you should be doing because you're essentially fighting them at no distance. But it feels really like feature complete, and I'm really looking forward to seeing how it does multiplayer, because I want to see my friends like doing all that VR stuff.
Yeah, that's
like,
right,
talking about co-op, like in the room with me, like I was having, you know, sword fights and bow fights and things. You can even have hand-to-hand combat, and it teaches you to just duck to get out the way of a robot that's trying to punch you in the face.
Sweet.
And stuff.
That's
awesome. I sweated a lot into the Vive. But the interesting thing about it, and I think it works because it's not an established IP. It is just original. They can do what they want. It has like a laser katana that you deploy, and it sounds a lot like a lightsaber and pistols and stuff. But they needed to build a world that could account for teleporting around, sort of weapons that sort of materialize and dematerialize and so on, and also lots of different things. So Cyberpunk kind of worked perfectly because it also means that all the characters can be robots and people in masks and stuff like that, and it's not as beholden to trying to do realistic people and so on. But the fact that it works and the amount of sort of fictional decisions it has to make around the world it's creating in order to sort of have some verisimilitude make me kind of question how something like Star Wars will fit that system, because you can't have teleporting in Star Wars really and still have it be Star Wars. So, you know, I do think so. I mean, in a way it's heartening, because in a way that's the proof that VR isn't just for sort of sedentary experiences. You can build a game out of it with mechanics that you master, but that is also really immersive and kind of like the best light gun game you've ever played in a way, because you're inside it and you've got full freedom of movement, and you actually feel like you're holding the guns, not just sort of, you know, firing a remote control at a TV.
Yeah.
But it has to be surrounded by this context that accounts for all of the weaknesses of what VR can and can't do. And it'll be interesting to see how those things sort of reconcile themselves in other contexts, because I imagine people are more excited to be a Jedi than they are to be a off-brand cyberpunk warrior.
Yeah.
It's super interesting.
Well, it also depends, because it's such a young technology. I mean, I know VR's been around for decades now in various forms, but this current sort of set of developers, or glut of game developers, rather, is, you know, this generation of VR has only sort of been around for a short while, and I'll be interested to see if people who have been working on games that are only just coming out have come up with different solutions. Because one of the other things that was announced today, or not announced, but released today, actually, was The Assembly, which is that, you know, moral, choicey, adventure, underground, bunkery thing. But it's... thing, it's kind of the thing that they mentioned in the blurb on, you know, the things that I've read about it, are very much that it was built from the ground up for VR. There is a non-VR version, but, you know, that's what they're sort of really sort of hammering home when they talk about it, as far as I can tell. And so it'll be interesting to see whether they've solved any of the VR conundrum in different ways than we've seen so far, because people like Colin Northway and Sarah, and, you know, the people who worked on Fantastic Contraption, came up with a whole host of different ways to deal with what would traditionally have been a menu system. And so it would be such a shame if that sort of began and ended with Fantastic Contraption and with, you know, budget cuts and things. And then everyone was just like, I guess that's how we do movement. I guess that's how we do menus now. And and so I'd really like to see what the rest of the year brings in terms of, does anyone do anything different with movement, or, you know, with reconciling any of the problems of the disjunct between the experience and then interacting with the experience.
Yeah, that's the thing. It feels like there are some orthodoxies coming into place, and for good reason, because, like, the teleportation thing, if that's the one that doesn't make you puke. But I'd like to see something else attempted, or... It's super interesting, though. And it's nice to see it shaping up so fast, and games sort of emerging that feel like genuinely new experiences. I like to keep playing it, but it is not the weather to strap a television to your face and jump around.
Yes.
Shall we do questions from questions?
Yes.
Although, I want to establish some caveats before we go into the question time.
What?
And the reason for that is, over the course of this podcast, somehow it's only gotten hotter. And as far as I can all tell, we are all getting stupider.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's now too hot to think. And many of the questions you sent in this week were hard. And as a consequence, we've decided to not tonight. We'll go through a bunch of questions.
But if our answers for later.
Yeah, if our answers are stupid or merely absent, then forgive us.
Apologize.
Yeah, forgive us.
Like, we've sweated out about 20 IQ points each over the course of the last hour.
Yeah.
It's not going to be good. But it might be entertaining if you're really lucky. So we're going to do it anyway.
What was entertaining was Pip spilling a Calippo on herself twice during the break.
Oh.
And that's a nice lolly contained entirely within a cardboard sleeve.
If you tip it upside down, then it sometimes rushes at your face.
What?
It does.
This is the level we're operating at.
Anyway, so I've got my cleaning lobster, so I'm fine.
Very involved and very intelligent questions about game design or the industry may not get the attention of the
finest.
Yeah, the audience they deserve today. Because it's hot as balls.
Are balls hot? I thought the point of balls was that they were outside the body. And
right now, Pip.
Okay.
Lots of hot balls in the room.
It's
horrible.
Oh.
I apologise.
Should not have asked.
Yeah. We walked into that one. Zed Fang writes, tournament rules for Warhammer Total War are that each player must play every race once over the course of a round of 5 battles. In other esports like StarCraft or LoL, players focus on learning 1 or 2 characters or races. Which is better? I thought this was interesting because a few different games use sort of forced faction switching or roster switching or whatever to essentially mitigate balance. And actually, I think it's actually more common than you think. The pick ban in Dota is functionally a way to force teams to not just roll out the same winning strategy a couple of times, and removes matchup variance as a major factor in determining who wins. It's a big deal in X-Wing, even though it's a miniatures game, that, you know, not necessarily faction differences, but list archetype, squadron archetype differences can make a big difference. And if you're in a big Swiss tournament with lots of rounds and your opponent is pretty randomly assigned, then you can get very lucky or not. Mm. Whereas having some degree of random faction selection mitigates that. It's something they started to bring in quite a lot. I think StarCraft is a sort of rare exception of a game where players aren't really asked to be a master of every part of the game, but one third of it, really.
Feels like it's such a complicated instrument that you have to master your one
also,
kind of faction.
Also, it's so much about, like, APM and muscle memory and build, like, order. And, you know, like, it's the sort of thing where deviating from that would lead to... Like, I think specialization is really key in those games, and you do still get variety because you get mirror matchups, or you get, you know, particular formations of the rock, paper, scissors that is the different races and things. But I think that it is key to that game that you can specialize to the point where you're just pressing keys at a crazy rate.
Lot.
Yeah.
Doing a lot of pushing keys.
Yeah. Typing. Typing.
Basically writing a letter. But the letter is I win. Lol. Dear you. I don't know what I'm talking about.
No.
The point is, yeah, I mean, Street Fighter is similar in that, you know, any character is expected to be able to beat any other character, so therefore you can...
I mean, does Warhammer have, like, a lot of variations across how the individual races have to play? Because I can imagine that if you are a player who plays a particular kind of way, then maybe there's a certain amount of bending each race to fit your own playstyle.
Well, this is what I was going to say, is that in a game like StarCraft, your choice of race doesn't necessarily counter one of the other races. It's not rock, paper, scissors.
So
there's
but
a lot,
you know,
of breadth within,
like,
the
three different things.
There's a lot of breadth within the in any given race to approach things in a different way, and you got to learn a lot of different matchups. Same is true of Street Fighter. Like, characters have different affinities and they might have situational advantages or disadvantages, but broadly speaking, your choice of character does not determine who will win the game. Whereas Warhammer, the differences are a lot starker and the limitations are much more keenly felt. The just factions just can't do some things, and so therefore the matchup is probably going to be a lot more important.
Yeah, balance doesn't exist in the same way in the Warhammer game than it does for these very, very painstakingly balanced you know, esports.
Hearthstone has that thing where you, if you win with a deck, you have to switch to a different deck, doesn't it?
So it's the same thing. Like, to answer the question, I don't think either of them is better or worse. It's just that they, a system where you switch up matchups and things allows you to have some imbalance in the system, especially when it creates a more interesting scenario. Like, Dota is interesting because it isn't necessarily balanced, but the pick ban system accounts for that and makes it part of the
it's interesting.
Contest.
Dota and StarCraft 2 are far too complex for this to happen, but when it comes to just, I mean, getting into tabletop gaming recently, and people form crutch strats where they've got the one thing that they do with the one army, and that's, you know, for in this particular patch, really, really good, but they don't actually understand the game. They understand how to do their one crutch strat and that's it.
Yeah.
And forcing people to, you know, diversify gives everyone a better sense of what the game is, and therefore probably makes for more interesting games, because everyone has a greater understanding of how to manipulate the rule set.
Yeah, it forces you to demonstrate understanding of the strategic breadth of the game, basically.
So for something like Total War, I can imagine that working a lot better than being stuck with dwarves and having to beat everything with dwarves.
Yeah.
Because dwarves are just also just naturally weak against certain things anyway.
Yeah.
Stupid dwarves.
Good answer. J. Richard Eddy writes, do you think there's unexplored design space in turn-based RPGs, or do they have to merge with other genres to expand? I think this is sort of an interesting one, because I'd say that, like, genre hybridization is a form of expanding and exploring the ideas inherent within a space. Like, it gets pedantic, because it's like, when you're talking about unexplored space that doesn't involve in some way maybe taking some cues from other genres, I don't really know what you're getting at. I mean, in that sense, I think maybe the concept of picking moves from a list and then beating up your opponent maybe is pretty much finished.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think genre hybridization is probably the biggest thing to happen to games in the last decade.
Mm.
The kind of inbreeding of genres and the kind of conflation of different ideas has led to new experiences, and you don't see necessarily completely new genres forming, with the exception of perhaps hopefully the Vive and this new platform will lead to that sort of thing. But all of the so take desktop tower defense, for example. That was just a kind of warping of the RTS in a way that just kind of mashed in some other genres, almost a kind of deck building element to it as well, and formed a new genre. But it's not really new, it's just a kind of it's in the kind of genetic tree of where that is going, and that kind of genetic diversification across games has been the source of creativity for the last decade, I think.
Mm.
One thing I'd say about turn-based systems in RPGs is I'd kind of like to see, for example, conversation systems are always turn-based, and I'd love to see more games that experiment, that disrupt that, and actually try and look at conversation systems that do more to take that away from turn-based scenarios. Mm. And it starts with the interrupt system in Mass Effect and things like that. And it could be chaotic, but it feels like an unexplored, untouched upon area.
Yeah.
I think Oxenfree has an element of that. Like, the conversations were... I can't remember exactly what it was about them, but they did do something that was better or, you know, more or different than just, you know, pick a thing and wait for it to happen. Because I think it's that when you trigger a piece of dialogue, it triggers in the game, and so the character will just cut the other one off.
Right.
And so you, I think, if I'm remembering it right anyway, and so you find yourself sort of waiting for the moment when you want to say it, but sometimes silence can be an option. And yeah. So, yeah, it was just quite interesting.
Telltale Games experimented with this a bit, like with the first Walking Dead game and before as well, but just by simply putting time limits on, it became an active time battle system, which is Final Fantasy invented many years before, but it had just been transposed onto a different section of the game. Mm. And suddenly that... it also behaved very differently in a conversational situation, and was made for a much more effective kind of conversational back and forth, and much more drama and pacing, changes of pace in conversations. Mm. Whereas the turn-based thing, the static turn-based thing, means that you get the call and response very slow as you want it to be, and you lose all the kind of sense of momentum and drama to a difficult situation.
Mm. I think that Firewatch does a certain amount of, you know, the thing where you have responses that you can give, or you could just do nothing, or you can trigger the next thing in the actual narrative part of it. Like, I'd be talking about some, you know, element of the environment, but then I'd be moving along to the, you know, the next sort of plot relevant location. And so there were times when I felt like I could have either carried on the conversation that I was having or switched it to the thing that we were now at.
Hmm.
In terms of,
did that feel more kind of physical, fluid than your traditional thing, or was it just an extension of the normal?
Some and some. Like, it was that thing of I became very aware while playing it that I didn't feel lonely in this wilderness because I was constantly being messaged by Delilah. And so I think that was slightly odd. Like, I'd have quite liked to sort of revel in some loneliness.
Mm.
Like, there's only sort of one section where you are, like, where the game purposely removes that from you. And I think I would have quite liked it to be a bit more present, you know?
Mm. Interesting.
But yeah, on the topic of turn-based RPGs, tricky. Because all the ways, yeah, I can think of making them more interesting involves hybridizing them.
Yeah, certainly.
Or making them not turn-based.
It does feel like they're played out, doesn't it?
Mm.
It does feel like they're played out. But there's a game released this week that people have been very fond of, which seems to be a call but throwback to turn-based Japanese RPGs. Oh my god, what is it called?
I Am Setsuna?
Yes.
Is it?
Yeah. So it clearly still has its fans.
Mm.
I'm just bored of it now.
Jonathan Sutcliffe writes, inspired by Pip's bug photos, what in-game critter would you most like to encounter in your garden?
Treasure goblin.
Treasure goblin. Yes. Would you beat it to death?
Smack it on the head with a shovel.
Oh dear.
It knows. Like, you know, if you go through life as a treasure goblin, I mean, you know, it should probably dress up as something else. A frog, for example. Like, I'm never going to hit a frog with a shovel.
No, indeed.
No.
You've thought this through.
I have. Well, I mean, I've been thinking it through as the words have come out of my face. I'm not entirely sure that that counts as an actual action plan. I don't know. Because there's lots of other kind of quite cool creatures in the garden, I mean, in games, but I don't know that they would necessarily fit in the garden. And, you know, Viva Pinata would be quite interesting to sort of actually have as inhabitants, but they sort of bring predators with them and breed. And so I don't want to get into a situation like with the snails where, you know, suddenly it's a case of being overrun with, I don't know, I've completely blanked on the names of any of the things, the fudge hogs, they're ones. So, you know, I don't want to have fudge hogs everywhere.
Well, why would you?
I'd have to beat them to death as well. There's so much that I could beat to death in the garden, but it's all video game stuff. You know, I wouldn't hurt anything that was actually there.
I'd like to encounter one of those elephant dudes from Mass Effect.
It's not really a critter, really. It's a person.
Yeah, but it looks like a really nice... I want to stroke it and pat it. And okay. That's good enough. And it would probably say, like, awkwardly, I am in your garden. And then I'd go, oh, it's okay, elephant dude. It's fine. Have Aww. This, Calippo.
Yeah, video games don't really have tiny, tiny creatures much either.
Like little bugs and things.
Like, yeah. They'll have bugs to a certain extent, but they'll have maybe some butterflies or they'll have, you know, some, like, points of particle effects that, in Dota, for example, masquerade as midges around the edges of the river or something. And so it can be a bit, like... I think that's why I'm sort of struggling with the question, because video games tend to sort of manifest things that are sort of from the size of a football upwards.
I think it was Marsh who was talking about Life is Strange, and he was talking about the fact that the birds in the sky were a particle effect or something. So it's just like actual animals has been reduced to a texture, a 2D texture that's kind of flowing over your head. That's kind of a nightmarish vision of critterdom. Charmander. I want a little...
I was going to say a Charmander.
Yeah, I put a Charmander in our garden.
Rad. You did, yeah. You hid one in the garden for me to find.
Oh. I made a live-action version Pokemon Go.
That's really funny.
I wouldn't mind meeting like a little Nug from Dragon Age. That'd be good. Little rat pig things.
Yeah, they're quite cool.
Little squeaky rat pigs. Give it a pat.
Maybe the chickens from Zelda, so I could go flying down the hill when I had to go into town. That would be nice.
The onion knight from Dark Souls. Again, not a critter, but, you know.
Are you really not sure what animals are you, Tom?
No, not today.
Maybe the Deku tree. That would You'd only have room for that, though. Yeah.
That's your house and your garden.
Yeah. And some hellish nightmare dungeon, like, underneath.
Those giant spiders in it, you know.
Have we... That's an answer. Surely. Sure. We've talked for long enough that it's probably answered something.
Okay. Thomas Young writes, Dear Crazy and Kruber... Ooh. First of all, I'd like to say how great an addition Pip has been to the podcast.
Yes, of email.
You're all great, of course.
Really?
But the unique tone that Pip brings to the podcast gels really well with everyone else. Anyway, on to my questions.
Thank you.
You have to choose to be a character from a video game and get to do all of the exciting things that character does. But your firstborn son or daughter ends up dating that character's nemesis. For example, this question's mad. For example, you can be Batman, but your son or daughter ends up dating the Joker. If you want to be Link, expect them to bring Ganondorf home on prom night. Being the hero of Wolfenstein sounds great until you have to have an awkward dinner with Mecha Hitler. Thanks for all the great podcasts. Thomas Young.
I don't know if I have an answer to that, but I'm really glad we read it.
What a good question.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of great game characters I would like to be with nemeses that I wouldn't mind someone I loved dating. Yeah, because there's an issue, like, I don't really want to be Mario, but I also don't want, like, to have to, like, an awkward dinner conversation with Wario either, really.
It's good that you said that, because I was sat there going, I don't mind dating Luigi, but then it's like, that's not his nemesis, that's his brother.
Yeah, Wario's Master Skis as well.
Wario's Master Skis. Bowser maybe would be more acceptable.
Yeah.
He owns property, so he's got that in his favour.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Lots of dowry.
Yeah, exactly. I'm trying to think. Let me start with powers I actually want.
Flight?
Hmm.
Space flight?
Actually, you know what? I don't mind being Charmander.
Who's Charmander's nemesis?
Squirtle.
Really?
Yeah. Because that was the original, starter Pokemon. Squirtle's one that counts as Charmander.
But is that not just opposites? Squirtle is the opposite of Charmander. That's not nemesis. That's
fire. Because if you, based on whatever you pick at the start, your rival will pick the one that's strong against it. So, in Pokemon. So, therefore, Squirtle is, in a sense, Charmander's nemesis.
So, if I was Bulbasaur...
Much as Gary is yours.
Who's Gary?
Your rival.
But why am I against Gary? Who's Gary?
Is this
Gary Newman?
No. Yes, it is.
But why? What have I done?
Nothing.
Is Gary a Pokemon?
No. Gary's a human boy.
Have I missed something?
You've added something.
He's Ash's nemesis.
Huh. Yeah, he's Ash's nemesis.
Oh, I thought Team Rocket was Ash's nemesis.
Also them.
No, they're a periodic foil.
Yeah. Okay.
But no, I mean, so what I'm saying is, if I was Charmander, then I'd be okay with my son or daughter dating Squirtle. Because Squirtle's ultimately a cool guy. He can't help that his essential element counters
me. Right, but if you were Ash, then you could be okay with your kid dating Jesse or James, right?
There's an age problem there.
Or if you were a Power Ranger, then your kid could date Rita.
Yes, that is the nature. That's the question, yeah.
Right.
But we have to now pick one.
But, I mean, I could be Rita and they could date one of the Power Rangers. Mm. That's all right. Isn't it? Like, because then you could just pick a Power Ranger. That's quite, or maybe they could all come round and it could be a weird, awkward dinner party.
The problem with that is they're not computer game characters.
There surely has been a Power Rangers.
Yeah, there probably
Rangers
has been, yeah.
Game.
Do you know what? I wouldn't mind my son or daughter going out with LeChuck from Monkey Island. That'd be
he'd
fine.
He'd be enough, wouldn't he? You get drunk with him.
Yeah, right. he'd be all right. Mm. I'll be Guybrush. They can go out with LeChuck. That's fine. that's my answer.
Oh. I don't know. I'm trying to think of something where, like, they're just people, you know? So I could just carry on being a regular person, and then my kid could maybe have happiness with another person who I just happen not to agree with on some tiny facet or something. I don't know. Or like, I could be a cool sailor and they could date a cool pirate. Or vice versa. Why are you looking at me like that?
Just trundles very slowly off-piste, that's all.
I mean, I'm just thinking, who is the natural predator of a sailor? And it's a pirate.
That's true, yeah.
So
this is dangerously close to opposites talk again, Pip.
I'm just trying to answer the question.
No. Tom, do you have a video game character you'd like to be?
Frankly, in no state to answer this question.
Okay, fair enough.
No ideas whatsoever.
A cold one.
A cold one, yeah. Geez.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah, Christ, let's move on. Fucking hell. Sorry, everybody.
I'm so sorry.
TJ writes, what kind of quests would the player complete in a dog-based MMO?
I've got this. Fetch quests.
Sold.
Actually, I would like a kind of territorial pissings thing, where you have to outpiss the other kind of animals. And
that's Splatoon, isn't it?
Yeah, a kind of reskin of Splatoon, I'll take that.
Maybe instead of going to see Hogger, you could go and see Dogger.
Pip, that means something else.
Oh. Oh, yeah.
That
was so close to clever.
It was clever, but it was also eerily true to the things that go on in Goldshire.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
But, like...
Yeah.
Isn't...
Yeah.
But, I mean, like... Okay, just to sort of make sure that I know what this means...
Mm.
Isn't dogging cars? Like, isn't it where, like...
Cars making love in the forest.
No, but it's people sort of, you know, bonking in a car, right? In a lay-by somewhere. And then you flash your lights at someone, and that means something. And then they know what to do, right? There's, like, a system. There's a system. It's quite well regimented, as far as I can tell. Isn't it? Like, how does that work in Goldshire? Is it like a car park?
For the Goldshire car park, yeah, in Elwyn Forest. So take it that I think maybe, you know, cars and flashing lights often play an intermediary role
right. In
dogging, but I don't think they're an essential component of the dogger's toolbox.
But also, but I assume that it's called dogging because people take their dogs there as well. You know?
Like, it's really not. No, Pip.
Is it not? Really, like, not. I thought maybe you could, like...
It's not sexy crufts.
No, I mean, I didn't mean anyone was doing anything weird with the dogs, but, like, is it not that's where you, like, maybe you'd walk your dog, but that's, like, a euphemism, so you take your dog along, but it's an excuse?
I'm not sure the etymology of dogging, to be honest.
No. That makes sense, doesn't it?
It does make sense. It's more about...
But none of these elements are present in MMOs, right?
Well, so if we take what I think dogging actually means, which is, like, you know, anonymous outdoor group sex with strangers.
Oh, did the other people join in?
Sometimes. Mostly it's voyeuristic, though, I hear.
Yeah, voyeuristic.
So I hear...
Dogging correspondent Thompson.
there's quite an interesting and slightly disturbing documentary on Channel 4 about it from last year.
Oh, okay.
That if you want all your questions answered about this, they all wear really creepy masks during it as well.
Really?
I don't know.
So this is, so if you're talking about kind of creepy voyeuristic encounters between people who are disguising their real identity, then what goes on in the Goldshire Tavern in Elwyn Forest and World of Warcraft after hours is not going to really fall too far out the definition of that.
Okay, so, but can I ask one more question?
Yes.
How do you be voyeuristic in an MMO?
You can see each other's text.
So you're not whispering? Is this like public chat?
Sometimes they can do it in public chat, sometimes they whisper. Sometimes you might just wander room to room and see what the gnomes are up to.
Does that mean something?
You should see what happens on the Deep Run tram, Pip.
Is a gnome a sex thing?
No, it's a race.
Oh, okay. I thought maybe it was just like a thing that I needed to watch a documentary on as well. Like, I'll just add it to the list.
Just look it up on Urban Dictionary, Pip.
Oh.
Many worlds have collided in the last 5 minutes.
Yeah, exactly.
This question was originally about dogs and MMOs.
I'm very sorry.
Well, you answered the question really, really well, and then we ruined it.
I know a lot more than I did.
But doggo was a good pun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought it was... anyway. Is there another question so we can move
Let's
on?
Find out, shall we? God, really? Is there... Okay, yes. Ian Ford writes, "Dear Codename Crate and Agent Crowbar, I recently returned from a couple of weeks in Italy to discover I'd missed two elusive targets in Hitman. I then contrived to miss the most recent one through visiting family for the 72 hours it was available. I realised the limited window is part of the appeal to some people, and this is what I paid and signed up for, but I can't help but feel cheated. I love the one-shot nature of the elusive targets. If I mess up, like the time I inexplicably forgot I was carrying a gun in Sapienza when I approached for a frisking and rightly got shot running away, then I accept that the contract has failed and I cannot repeat it. So my complaint is not with their difficulty, but the contrivance of blocking me from ever attempting the contract in the first place. Having paid for the game, don't I deserve the same opportunity to play its content that everybody else who has happened to be home at the time? Interested to hear your thoughts, Ian. P.S. I got engaged while I was in Italy, so obviously I'm 100% happy right now and not remotely bitter about missing something in a video game."
Congratulations,
but I'm so, so sorry that you missed two cracking elusive targets that I also didn't do. Actually, I did one of them.
I've been away for all of them so far, so which discourages me from doing any of the ones in the future.
It sounds like he managed to hit an elusive target. I don't know where I'm going with that. It was kind of like an engagement thing, like where the person had said yes, and that was
he must be a hit man
target, and he'd got a strategy all worked out. And I'd quite like to stop talking if I'm honest.
I think regarding the question.
yes, thank you.
I think it's fair because they were completely transparent from the start about what this would be and how it would work. And they didn't kind of trick anyone out of money for promising it for it to operate in any other way. I think it would be a very nice gesture of them for at some point to give people a second crack at it, maybe. Even though they have kind of promised that it's a one-off thing. But if they came back like a year from now and said, hey, the twins are back on this weekend, and kind of they build up this repertoire of one-off hits that they kind of wheel back out in the next season of Hitman or something. That would be a nice thing.
I think you could make it sort of law appropriate to the extent that Hitman has law, in that you could sort of, because they are still alive in that person's universe, so if they came back around, like that could, you know, still be meaningful or whatever, and you do sort of get a second bite at the cherry. But I think from what I can tell as an outsider who doesn't play Hitman, something that I have noticed is that the elusive targets have been quite erratic in terms of their actual spacing, and things have just sort of appeared. And I think that there's an appeal to that, but I think that when there's that element of unpredictability, that you can just be really unlucky and miss, you know, most of them or all of them, just because that's how your diary lines up. And so something that I wonder is whether it would be maybe better to have things that will definitely happen at particular points, like how Destiny has Iron Banner weekends that you know are coming and you won't be able to make all of them, but you know, you know in advance that they exist, and then maybe intersperse that with super special stuff. So there's the element of, you know, knowing when some of them are probably going to happen, or having a window that you know you'll either be there or you won't, but then, you know, other sort of extra bonus ones that are just totally a surprise would be quite nice.
Yeah, I think that's a sound idea. I failed one now due to a bug which pissed me off, and I've missed one now, the most recent one, just because I didn't realize it was on. And it is a bit of a shitty feeling to realize you've missed it. I think because they remain present in the UI, like months, like even maybe a month later, if I load up Hitman, the elusive target I failed is still one of the main panels on the front screen, even though there've been three elusive targets since. And that sort of thing is really, like, I think they need to make it feel less like a punishment for simply missing. Like, failing I kind of get, although it's annoying, but missing them, I don't know. Like, if they're genuinely temporary and they're not going to come back, then I don't really know if you need a big list of them in a menu that you can dig through and just see a big load of red X's next to things you didn't do.
Yeah.
Like, sure. they do build some sort of ill feeling into the system, I think, in a way they don't need to.
Well, I think because games have, for better or for worse, over the last decade or so, built up kind of achievement culture and 100%-y culture, I think that it can be quite a miserable experience to have a less than perfect record of a thing. And so I think that it's quite nice to think of different ways to present it, you know, ways that it doesn't feel like, you know, like that you still want to take part and there's still cool rewards or kudos for having done so, but not in the way that, oh, well, I guess I've missed one, so what's the point in, you know, like I can never have a perfect record, so why would I continue with this? I think that's a sentiment that I've seen crop up a few times.
Nathan writes, at this point, I'm not even sure who to turn to, and you guys are some of my favourite game critics, reporters, and in Tom's case, he means the other Tom, devs. I respect each and every one of your opinions deeply. That's very kind. A couple of months ago, my team and I released a game on Steam, but we have little to no pull in the industry. Our lead dev has a good chunk of followers on Twitter, and we thought that making a good, visually appealing game and spreading the word would be enough to grab people's attention. He goes on to sort of give some details about the extent of the project and how many years it took them. It wasn't enough. We've had a couple of interviews and articles here and there, but sales have been abysmal. We get a couple of hundred upvotes on our posts to Reddit occasionally. That's about the most attention we get. So my question is, how the hell do we get coverage from some of the bigger sites and garner a productive relationship with the media? We've talked to the guys at PC Gamer and RPS, but it's always, I'll run it by my boss response. Loving the podcast, keep up the good work. Best wishes, Nathaniel Grove. And he says the game's name is Song of Seven, Chapter 1. It's kind of an interesting one because it's a question you get asked a lot, and I think you get maybe different answers different times.
Well, there's not any one answer, really, is there?
Well, something that certainly helps thinking about it is that, and it's the other thing Tom says, which is that you need to be able to sum up what your game is and why it's different in basically a short sentence. And if you can't do it in a short sentence, write a better short sentence. And if you still can't do it in a short sentence, have a think about the design. If it genuinely you can't express what's different and interesting, why people should care quickly. And you don't just do that because it allows you to, I don't know, burst through the email resistance of games journalists who don't want to read them. It's not actually true. It's because if your game is genuinely unknown and we have to get people to click on it, we also need to be able to present it to people in a quick way that makes them go, oh, I want to check that out. Because otherwise the effort on our part is wasted. Because if we have to do all that legwork of trying to explain why you should care about something and it's hard for us to be successful, then the case for us covering it is not necessarily that convincing.
When I said that there's not one answer, it's because I think the reasons that you might cover something are quite wide-ranging. Like, something might catch my eye because it touches on a particular topic that I happen to be interested in at the time, or that I'm actively looking for, not case studies, but you know what I mean, for a feature on a particular topic. And so maybe that would stand out to me, or perhaps it's, you know, got a unique visual style that that speaks to me in a screenshot that I see of the game. Or, you know, it might be that it's relevant because it taps into a wider conversation about something else, you know. There are just so many reasons that things might stand out. I think it's very, very important to be able to sum up what the game is and what's unique about it. But I also think that, you know, it's good to just be aware that there are a whole heap of reasons that somebody may or may not cover the thing that you're sending them. And so one of the things that I usually tell people when they ask this kind of question is to have a look at what individual people actually write about, because it might be that you are sending your, you know, maybe if you've made a delightful indie puzzle game and you are sending it to their FPS like AAA specialist, then, you know, that might not work. Or, you know, keep an eye on Twitter, because a few of the games journalists I know sometimes put calls out for particular people to get in touch, or for, you know, games like that. And I also look on stuff like, oh, its name is totally escaping me right now, the TIG forums.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, GIFs of games being worked on. I will go to that thread quite a lot and sort of pick things out of it, or particular dev blogs that are being updated through particular forum threads are, you know, interesting as well. Or, you know, uploading things for Screenshot Saturday on Twitter. And sort of it's that just being aware that people garner content from so many different sites, and being present in those in a way that shows your game off to its best advantage, or picks out the actual super interesting things about it that you've been working on as well. Like, that stuff really helps.
I think it helps to adopt the mindset of someone who's writing an article, not necessarily someone who's selling a game, because you kind of have to be able to answer to the time of the person doing the coverage. And so if you can say, approach it from the point of view of not even necessarily what's great about the game, but why is this an interesting story? Like, why should a reader care? And that helps a lot. Like, I think of a recent example where the creators of Element Tower Defense, which was like it was the most popular mod for Warcraft 3. It was more popular than Dota, but it didn't have the subsequent second life that Dota did. And the guys who made it went off into other parts of software development, including Riot, and they kind of came back to it and kickstarted it recently, and it's now a thing. And it's not like an area of games I particularly know very much about, but they came to me saying, this is interesting because this is the story of the game that could have been Dota and isn't.
That's a really good hook.
And like, that's a great hook. Like, if a freelancer came to me and said, I want to investigate this game that has a huge audience but didn't have that lasting kind of cultural impact,
yeah,
that's really interesting. The fact that it was developers bringing it to me was great, because then I can just go talk to them directly.
If you've got a story, tell your story, basically.
Yeah, and that, I mean, I don't know whether that did anything for them in terms of interest in their game or whatever, but that's sort of their concern after that. The point is, I got a story for my channel that was relevant to my channel as well. Because, like, tower defense might not have registered for me as someone who mostly edits esports and competitive stuff, but finding that really strong link and saying, this is why this should be interesting to you, was successful for them. And it goes beyond, here's my game, and into, here's a story.
Yeah.
And that's because, you know, if you make game, I make story on website. And they have to reconcile those two things.
You end up with that whole pitch me a headline kind of thing. And that's actually quite a useful way of also streamlining what you explain your game to people as, in that way that you were saying Tom advises, you know, that one sentence hit of information, but also excitement and stuff. And that's where maybe some non-game savvy or less game savvy friends come in as well. You know, you kind of tell them what your game is and then ask them to explain it back to you, and if they can't, or if what they think is radically different to what you're actually working on, then it means that there's something being lost in the translation there as well.
Yeah, and there's just common sense stuff, like, don't do it during E3 or Gamescom or
on a Friday GDC evening.
Or, I mean, yeah. I mean,
like, all, just because it gets stuff lost in what comes in over the weekend. Or,
yeah, I mean, it tends to be like January, February, March, good bet. Like, and just before E3 when no one's announcing anything, that's another good bet.
Or in the lull after E3.
Yeah, if you've sent around a load of emails to people and on that same day Rockstar announced GTA 6, send those emails again a week later.
Yeah.
Because that's just going to get crushed. So just kind of be aware of what, if something big happens alongside the stuff you're sending, just don't be afraid to send it again.
Also, never start an email saying, you won't want to read this, but, or like things like that. Like, I get that a surprising amount of time, or like,
sorry, but yeah.
Yeah, or other forms of that, or kind of, even things that are quite aggressive in terms of, well, you never replied to my previous, it's kind of like, well,
another good idea is, don't try to look too much like a press release, because press releases, press releases are terrible, and 90% of the time, if you're having a busy day, it's the first thing you can skip. Like, an email that looks like it's been personalized in some way or addressed directly to you, you'll read, because, you know, that, you know, I mean, because that could be correspondent that requires an immediate response. It doesn't necessarily have to be a sort of intro.
I'll especially read it if it's got my name right.
Yeah, exactly. Dear Plop.
I've had Philip. I've had Alice. I've had Adam. Stephen. Yeah. You know, all of those.
Skip. Whereas, like, I've seen indie developers sort of adopt the kind of presentation of a press release. Like, there are companies, there are big game publishers that will always do like all caps subject lines, and it'll always start with like breaking, comma, you know, like thingy thing to do thingy thing. And those emails, like, I've, you know, 5 years of this has meant my brain skips them. Like, they have been archived before they land, simply because my brain doesn't really even see the words now.
Conventional press release formats are absolutely dreadful, and don't ever copy them. It's like multiple bolded bits, massive block paragraphs, and it's impossible to parse for information.
But something that is useful, that I've found useful as somebody who is then seeking out more information if something has caught my eye, is it Rami's press kit sort of template that will let you put all of the details that a person who is looking for that information for an article might actually need. So the details of the people at the studio, a synopsis of the game, a bunch of screenshots, maybe GIFs, maybe embeddable videos, you know, that kind of stuff is super useful to have in that format, because that means that you don't then have to dedicate the entirety of the email to providing that information. You can just sort of do the super exciting news that you're sharing with people and then say, for everything that you might need, you know, we've included one screenshot that might also grab your attention and is representative and cool, but, you know, go here for all of the other information that you need.
Yeah, it's good. It's great. I've been to like really big developers, and I've gone to their website looking for screenshots and had to press like what was F11 to get into the code of the site and then to look for the source.
Yeah, resources, and then images.
Don't make press do that because you're only going to do that for big sites. Anyway, that's a lot of industry stuff, but hopefully it's useful.
Someone. Okay. Utkrish Dankar writes, "Dear Physics Engine Demonstration Objects, mods for games are huge in many PC gaming communities. A game like Skyrim is still extremely popular due to its excellent modding community. A niche game, Arma 2, exploded into the mainstream when the DayZ mod came out. Mods can extend a game's lifetime almost indefinitely or even create entirely new experiences out of a game. However, it is rare to see mentions of a game's moddability or the mods available or the modding community present for a game in any piece of criticism of that game. The only example I can think of was the RPS review of Kerbal Space Program, which touched on the excellent modding community. Do you think that more game reviews should include mentions of the mods for a game, or be updated later when modding community develops? Or do you think that reviewers should only include what the developer put out when giving their opinion on a game?" I reviewed Kerbal Space Program for a few places and mentioned the modding community every time because it stood out as a very important part of that game.
And it has been out in early access and there was a modding community, and that doesn't exist for a lot of games, obviously.
Yeah.
So it's very easy to point to that and say this is a guaranteed chunk of entertainment. I think the reason why people are often reticent to do it is because there's a certain amount of expectation of support for the product you've bought that doesn't apply to the mods that also come with the product. So you can read a review 5 years later that might mention a specific mod, and that mod might quite well not work or not have been updated in the same way. So it's about kind of preserving the integrity of the recommendation in that way.
Yeah, and similarly there's a risk inherent of making any kind of gesture forward in a review. So if you say because obviously you don't know that a mod team will necessarily grow up, but you can say the game comes with mod tools, and you could say that, like, well, you know, the longevity, or you know, maybe it's something a little bit simpler than mod tools. Maybe it's a mission editor that you can share in the Steam Workshop. And that, you know, hypothetically, you can say in a review, well, you know, the longevity problems that the game might have are solved by the fact that it's got modding tools and a workshop integrating or something. But actually, you don't know that at that stage. No. You don't know if people are going to take it up. You don't know if they'll enjoy using the tools. You don't know if they'll, the community will take to it in sufficient volume, or if the levels will be any good, or if they'll match up with the quality of the base game. All of these things are unknown until they happen. Which is one of the reasons you do a lot of post-launch coverage for that stuff if it takes off. But in a review, again, because you have to, especially, maybe this comes from approaching things from a print background where once you've printed it, you've printed it. You don't necessarily want to put something in there that could read very, very wrong in a year after you've written it.
I think the other thing is when you are reviewing something, you're sort of assessing what somebody will get when they pay for something and kind of expectations tied in around that, and what they might get is, you know, perhaps a really healthy modding community a little bit further down the line, but the things that the developers and publishers and whoever can be beholden to don't extend to that unless there's a very particular agreement in place or a very particular setup. And so I think that can be another factor. Like, I wouldn't want to factor in, you know, particular mods or, you know, what the mod scene might be in my appraisal of what a particular team at a studio have produced. I'd write about stuff that was really interesting, you know, later down the line, or, you know, things that caught my eye. Like, there was a mod for Life is Strange which reworked Max as a goth, which I actually really liked and sort of caught my attention. But and the other thing is that I think it can be easy to forget when you're super like au fait with it, but modding does still present a barrier to entry. You know, when I'm installing Skyrim mods, it requires a particular sort of set of extra tools, a particular sort of appreciation of how bits plug into each other, that certain things might then affect other things or break things, or, you know, how to go backwards if you manage to absolutely ruin how doors work or something because you applied a wind mod or something. And I think that kind of thing can be you know, it's not as simple as I downloaded this thing and it works or it doesn't, or it fulfills these expectations or it doesn't. It's kind of, it's a very different kettle of fish in my own
And experience. Mods are so easily covered outside of a review as well, with separate randoms, things like that, that it feels like, yeah.
Yeah, we've had whole features on like GTA mods and Skyrim mods and all of that.
All that good stuff.
In some cases as well, like mods will be factored into the subsequent criticism is written about a game, because I mean he has criticism, not necessarily reviews, but like I think everything I've written about Skyrim since it came out has impacted that mod community in some way.
Yeah.
Similarly, like a game that I've sort of written about perennially in PC gamer all time lists is Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines, which has a big, it's not quite a mod, but it's a big community made patch that basically is the thing that fixes that game. And now I sort of factor that in. Like, I think it's a great game and everyone should play it, and everyone probably has because it's been £2 in the Steam sale a million times. But I sort of factor the fact that, like, okay, the developers released it in a bit of an unfinished state and it never quite got the care it needed after launch, but the community fixed it, therefore you should play it.
Yeah.
Like, that sort of thing is perfectly viable now.
That was the other thing that I was going to say. Like, that's the one game that where I talk about it in just the regular mill of coverage, I will always mention the mod because... Or the community created
fix.
Bit of it that actually enables it to even run when you pick it up. So yeah, like I guess the only other thing I would say is that modding also involves a significant time investment, and there's a certain amount of, you know, moving on to the next thing because games are being released all of the time, and that's the thing that's clogging up our inbox, meaning that we can't read every single email, you know, to go back to the previous question, sort of with, you know, that loving sort of hour-long stint of research and appreciation and things. And so I think that, you know, I can barely keep up with that a lot of the time, and it'll only be if I'm spending an absolutely super significant amount of time with a game, or a particular mod has been flagged up, you know, on some of my feeds as particularly interesting, that I'll actually have time to sit down, reinstall the thing, work out what I'm doing, make sure that it's all working properly, and then you know, get into it.
That is all of the questions we've got time for.
Ooh.
If you send us a question, we didn't read it out. Apologize.
We're melting to death. Melting.
If you'd like to send us a question for a future episode of the podcast, you can do so by emailing us questions@creightandcrowbar.com. Alternatively, you can leave a question on the forum, creightandcrowbar.com/forum, or you can tweet us @creightandcrowbar. You can discuss this episode on the forum, the same address, or on Discord. And there'll be a link in the show notes, which are available at creightandcrowbar.com, or in the sidebar of the website. If you'd like to follow us individually, I'm @cthurston, that's C-T-H-U-R-S-T-E-N. Pip is...
@pentadact, P-E-N-T-A-C-T. Wait, no. Oh, we'll follow that person, see how they are.
Pentatact.
I could be the rival Tom, couldn't I?
You've already got one of them.
Hang on. Pentadact. It's really difficult. Tom, I have a lot more respect for you.
I'm @PCGLudo, which is LEDO.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
Fucked it. Absolutely.
Panta tanked.
Was that Pandact?
I don't know. P-E-N-T.
Pandact.